I can believe that. Yes, you can believe that.
It does seem incredible.
This is the time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Big one. All right. We'll see what it is. It's kind of the tweaks and the fixing and the thing. This is Michael's. That's a present.
She worked last night. I
read.
And that's
for
people who's going off of GM.
Different issue. This is the presumptive eligibility for children. Whose idea was this? Something that was passed.
Give it to me. Mark's right.
Okay. Thing well, that was passed
go
down.
With it.
I
go
mean,
with it. Get a fiscal note.
Well, it's our topic.
Okay.
And then that's Michael's. Just, that's pretty self-explanatory with the comments that he runs himself. So. You're kidding.
I don't oppose it.
Okay.
All right. So we'll do this. Presumptive eligibility for children.
I would
have
loved
it.
Senator, they just got this to me at 8:35.
Yeah.
I haven't figured out the access from one that I expected to see, and I have no idea. And I think it's got to be related to the first. I just haven't had a chance to look at it.
Like everything. Thank you very much. New agenda list, because this guy. I'm going to go do
it. You're going over first. And I'm going to go in this order.
It's just seen it for
outrageous.
The first time 5 minutes ago.
Much higher than that.
Well, no, I mean,
oh my gosh,
it's less, but
oh my
it's taking out this. It still looks like it's part of this transitional Minnesota care thing.
In front of 45 at ESR Rose.
Yeah, it's still in there.
Okay.
Yeah. The only reason this is high or higher, I mean, higher than I expected.
They haven't taken it out
yet. No, I thought they would, but.
I know it's been a lot.
Yeah, but that's not just being sponsored.
Oh, Mary.
Oh, yeah. No, but one of the things they want to do is to get the.
Yes, she would be. But she's in a. It's probably better than.
Everything go up just
until.
Oh, okay. I don't know if you want to go up together.
Late fiscal notes are getting.
I just want to go to the evening one.
I didn't receive this until.
I'll do that. I'd do that with you. All right.
At 8:45. I got an email.
Okay, let's do it.
By Barb at 8:30, sir. Good
morning, Linda. Good day for you.
Yeah,
now
we
have to. Yes. Well, thank you for sending them over to me.
Sorry, Linda.
Okay.
Start anyway.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Good today.
Look, well, the transitional costs, I thought we were going to cut out of there.
Right now.
Are you looking for a while?
make sure that the Squire fill that out?
She's just going to introduce it and then what she's going to do.
So you'll
come on. Interesting.
Michelle.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
The meeting of the Health and Human Services Budget Division will be called to order. On today's agenda, we have Senate File 2, Senator Berglund, the health care bill. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think we have in your packet some handouts that look like this. And so what this handout shows you is the number of uninsured children according to the Department of Health survey in 2004. And you can see that just a little over 18% were children. But of those 73,000 children, 78% were uninsured but were eligible for a public health insurance program. So that left around 16,000 that were not eligible for any program. And you see the rest of the chart, the various age groups that are uninsured, and they add up to 304,000. But 55% of those are eligible for a public program. So you can see the largest part of the problem of the uninsured is adults, and the largest number of people that are not eligible for a public program today who are uninsured are adults. Having said that, we do believe that we have, in Senate File 2, taken care of all of the uninsured children, or virtually all of the uninsured children.
Madam Chair?
Senator Sharon.
Senator Berglund, would you direct me to the, is that the graph you're looking at? Thank you. Thank you.
And on the Senator second Berglund. Page of this chart, it shows the amount of uncompensated hospital care. And in this chart, we have data up through 2005, so we have one more year of data. And what you can see is that the hospital uncompensated care is going up, and you can see that it's gone up again in 2005, and that would lead us to believe that we have more uninsured than the 2004 survey showed us. Madam Chair, before we take the testimony on the bill, the last thing I'd like to do is to go through the fiscal note, but I'd like to take some amendments now, take the testimony, and then go through the fiscal note. Okay. So I'd like to begin with the A-34 amendment.
I believe the A-34 amendment is being distributed.
You can just hand them all out, A-34, A-32, and A-33.
Okay.
And A-31, I guess.
Senator Berglund, you wish to start with the A-34 amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
Page 1, line 1 would allow dual eligible people to use the prescription drug discount program, and that would allow them, if there is a drug that they need that is not covered by Medicare Part D, they could use that program to purchase the drug if they chose to. Lines 3 through 16 clarify the outreach efforts, establishes a trainer program for people who would be training people in their community to help people fill out the applications, ensures that the drop boxes are emptied, and coordinates the efforts with the maternal and child health outreach efforts, and requires a statewide telephone number to be offered in different languages. Line 17 through 22 specifies the critical access dental providers' reimbursement increase at 33%. This was the amount of the increase that they received last year. Lines 23 through 28 make the GAMC transitional enrollees eligible for Minnesota Care without reapplying before transitioning into Minnesota Care after 6 months. This requires the enrollees to notify the commissioner of an increase in income or if they have access to employer-subsidized insurance. Okay. Lines 29 through 36 clarify that the employer-subsidized insurance barrier does not apply if the applicant has access to employer-subsidized insurance, but the employer-subsidized insurance, if the subsidized employer insurance costs them more than 8% of the employee's gross family income, then they would still be eligible for Minnesota Care. It also states that costs include the annual premium that the employee has to pay and any annual out-of-pocket expense limits. Page 2, lines 1 to 11 make clarifying changes to the critical access dental provider payment in Minnesota Care. Lines 12 through 28 on page 2 make changes to the small employer buy-in option, and this includes lifting the inpatient benefit limit for adults and requiring inpatient hospital services to be paid using the medical assistance rate minus $20,000 and any applicable co-payments or co-insurance. Lines 29 and 30 repeal the section making students at post-secondary institutions with access to health and coverage, health insurance coverage through the institution ineligible for Minnesota Care. So we're repealing that portion.
Okay. Are there any questions on the A34 amendment? Okay, Senator Berglund. On the A34 amendment, do you have a motion?
I move the amendment.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A34 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund, would you like to proceed with the A33 amendment?
Yeah, we could do that one next.
Okay. The A33 amendment. Senator Berglund.
The A33 amendment establishes presumptive eligibility for children who have provided information, preliminary information that would show that their income is less than 90% of the applicable income standard and have liquid assets less than 90% of the asset limit and who meet all other income eligibility requirements.
Okay. Senator Berglund moves the A33 amendment. Are there any questions? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A33 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund, would you like to?
Let's do the A32 amendment, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the A32 amendment.
Okay. Senator Berglund moves the A32 amendment.
This amendment sort of merges two different ideas that the community clinics have had. One is care coordination, which was in the bill, and the second is providing patient education services. And this amendment extends MA coverage to the care coordination and patient education services that would be provided by community health workers if supervised by medical assistance enrolled provider. So it allows both the care coordination and the community health worker concept to be blended here.
Senator Berglund moves the A32 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A32 amendment is adopted. And that brings us to the A31 amendment. Senator Berglund.
And the A31 amendment is an amendment that has been, again, requested by some of the safety net providers, and it would provide a one-time grant to a research center associated with a safety net hospital to develop the capabilities necessary for evaluating the effects of changes in state policy on low-income and uninsured individuals including the impact on state health care program costs, health outcomes, and cost shifting to various levels of government, and the effect of emergency room care and hospitalization rates.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Berglund, what research center is this going to, and what is defined as the safety net hospital?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prentner-Solon, this is a research capability that Hennepin County Medical Center has to evaluate the trends of the uninsured and how it cost shifts onto private insurance, onto public institutions, onto other programs at the state level when eligibility is cut in one program. And this would be one-time money for them to do this evaluation.
So, Senator Berglund, is it a statewide study?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Berglund moves the A31 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A31 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund, I believe that's the end of the amendments.
And so, Madam Chair, I'd like to take testimony now, and then we can go over the fiscal note later.
All right. We have a lengthy list of testifiers today. So I would ask that each person keep that in mind as we're working through this agenda. And we'll start today with Leanne and Ted Erickson. And I would ask the testifiers as they come forward that there is a paper at the table, and if you could please note your name and address, contact information for us, that'd be appreciated.
Okay. I actually don't see the paper right here.
Okay. We'll get that to you.
Can I do it later?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Ms. Erickson, Mr. Erickson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Leanne Erickson. I live at Sherburn, Minnesota, and this is my son, Ted. He lives in Fairmont, Minnesota. Ted is 43 years old. He has mental retardation, Tourette syndrome, sleep apnea, and a very severe seizure disorder. In spite of his multiple disabilities, Ted lives semi-independently with his brother in his own home in Fairmont. Ted takes 6 different medications daily. Plus, he needs to keep a 7th on hand to use during a seizure. Most of his medications dealing with seizures cannot be generics. It's been a very long process to get Ted's seizures under control, but we now have a medication course that has eliminated many of Ted's hospital stays. Ted works at the Sheltered Workshop in Fairmont 8 to 4, 5 days a week. There are some side effects with Ted's meds, and his work output suffers. That means his paycheck is affected. Ted works the same hours as his brother, Jim, who also has mental retardation and autism, but usually he earns only half as much money. Ted's paychecks many times are in the $50 range for 2 weeks of work. Ted is on Medicare as well as medical assistance. Medicare does not limit copays. Most of his copays are $3, so when he needs to refill all his medications, it's $21 a month. That's close to 20% of his take-home pay many, many, many weeks. Some of his medications cause gum problems, and so Ted needs periodic deep cleaning dental services. It was just a huge worry removed when the 205 legislature eliminated the cap on dental expenses, and we thank you for your work on that. However, I just did get a call from Charlie in Worthington, and he had received a letter from his dentist telling Charlie that he would no longer be able to come for dental work there because his dentist had not received an increase in fees since 1980, and he no longer would serve people with medical assistance. And Charlie is disabled. There's not much transportation in the rural areas. He doesn't know how he can get to another dentist if he can't go to one in his own town. So we do need to do some work on that. Ted used to live in a waiver house with 3 other housemates, and when he moved into his own home, it meant leaving behind some of the built-in financial security that Ted received as a resident of that house. If he still lived there, he would get $12 a month to use for medications, whether he used any medications or not. He would also be receiving other assistance as well. The people who are living as independently as possible and at less cost to the taxpayers are the people who are most affected by co-pays. They're living semi-independently. They have limited support services, and they may not pursue resources available to them. For instance, pharmacists are required to fill prescriptions when people can't pay. But if a pharmacist refuses to fill a prescription, many of our people will just leave and not go back, and they'll go without their meds. They don't always understand all the paperwork. Medicare Part D plans are overwhelming. Ted's first Part D plan that was assigned to him would have cost him $148 a month because one of his medications wasn't included in their formulary. We found a plan that covers all of his meds, so he pays the $21 in co-pays, but not the rest of it. Not everyone knows that there is help out there and where they can go for help. When Ted left the four-bed waiver house, we knew he was leaving behind a lot of financial security. We felt that the increased quality of life would greatly offset the financial loss, and we were right in that respect. Also, the fact that by living semi-independently saves the taxpayers about $1,500 a month on Ted's behalf is very appealing to us also. Co-pays are a real burden to people like Ted. Ted and his friends are the least able to afford these extra costs and probably the most at risk for emergency room intervention. It makes sense to eliminate copay, and we just appreciate any support you can give us in doing that. Thank you very much.
Ms. Erickson, Mr. Erickson, thank you for your testimony. Next, we will hear from Alva Neubauer. Ms. Neubauer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam and chairs and members of the committee. My name is Alva Neubauer, and I work as a housekeeper in United Hospital in St. Paul. And I'm also a member for the SEIU Local 130. I am here today to show support for the Senate 502. This will allow families like mine to take Minnesota care. I am a single divorced mom with four children. As a housekeeper, I make about $900 every 2 weeks, about $33 per year. Until a couple years ago, my kids were covered under Minnesota care, but they were taken off the program because my employer, Alina Hospitals and Clinics, pay more than 50% of the premiums. In that time, what they did was very hard for me because my daughter, Elizabeth, my second daughter, has some disability that was the teachers point me that she was very smart, but she has some problems. She has speech problems. So I had appointments with doctors to go through her to find out what was wrong, if we can help her to improve the school. And the day I had already all the appointments because I tried to do it the same day, not to miss too much days of work. I got a call from my dentist, was the first tell me I cannot take my children to the dentist, and then I had to cancel all my my appointments with the doctors because I didn't have insurance. And it was very devastating. I remember being crying in prison, all my children walking in the room, and we all crying because it was my only hope to find out what was wrong with her, and I couldn't do it. But to go back to put them in my insurance and work, it was I has to do it. I had no choice. My daughter was important, and I has to do it. So I did it. 6 months later, I was able to start going to the doctor. But I also has to be charging my groceries and my credit cards because My premiums were high. I couldn't afford to do it by myself when that much money I made. My housekeeping equal to a paid living is like $900 every 2 weeks, taking home that. My house payment is like, right now is like $900. It used to be $900, but now it's $940 since they raised the taxes. So it takes me, my premiums are like $230 and like 13% of my income. And this not counting the co-insurance and co-payments to go to the doctor to do it. Since then, my coworkers and I, we negotiated a new contract, and we had more affordable insurance. Alain agreed to get a full pay family insurance. We hope in the next time we negotiate, we're able to do that. We don't know. My coworkers are still pay 8%. Sometimes they are part time. Sometimes from being working 0.8, they have to go down to be able to be eligible to get a health insurance because they can't afford to do it. Being in Minnesota care will be much more affordable for them. So I am here to support Senate File 2. This change will be good for Minnesotans, and I know you want to make this change. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Joanne Tisar. Ms. Tisar, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Excuse me while I compose myself here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for continuing to work hard on health care policies that have troubled many in our great state. My name is Joanne Tisar and mother of Curtis Brian Deem Jr. I am here to tell his story. Curtis was diagnosed in May of 2003 with type 1 diabetes, more commonly called juvenile diabetes. Curtis was finishing his junior year of high school and starting his senior year. During the week-long stay in the hospital, Curtis learned that he would never be able to fulfill his dream of being in the U.S. Army and being a firefighter due to the disease. Even with that blow to his future, he never let the disease control him. He controlled the disease. My excellent employer-paid health insurance helped to keep him healthy, strong, and athletic. Because Curtis never aspired to attending college when he was 19, he lost my health care insurance. We attempted to obtain medical assistance but were denied due to my income. Medical assistance referred us to Minnesota Care, where again we were denied due to my income of $34,000 a year. During this time, Curtis was just entering the workforce, holding part-time, very low-wage restaurant jobs. I did what I had to do to keep him supplied in his medication, equipment, and doctor visits that cost nearly $7,400 a year. Between Curtis's medical needs and the mortgage, we had about $4,900 left for the year to pay any other household expenses. Due to the doctor clinic bills, Curtis has started his adulthood with poor credit. In order for Curtis to obtain Minnesota care, he moved into his own place just before he turned 20. He was finally able to get Minnesota care, yet medical assistance would not help him with his arrears doctor bills because he had been living with me in the past. But nevertheless, he was back on track because of Minnesota Care and able to keep his appointments with the doctor without fear of more debt. Curtis came up for renewal for Minnesota Care in December of 2006, this past December, and found himself again disenrolled from Minnesota Care. He finally has a job at $11 an hour that eventually went full-time with a 25-cent an hour raise. He lost Minnesota Care because he gained 6 hours more per week and received $11.25 an hour. Not only was that a setback, but his employer-paid insurance doesn't start until April of this year. Minnesota Care would not keep him on during this transition time. This past Sunday, this previous Sunday, my son, who has a very healthy appetite and needs to maintain his diet as healthy as possible, chose to eat one meal that day in order to conserve his medication, because every time he eats, he needs to take a prescribed number of units of insulin. Cutting life-saving medication in half is not a senior citizen issue only. It is also an issue for young adults with life-threatening illnesses. Curtis is on three different medications, two of which I brought samples of right with me. Two of which are insulin, the other is for his kidneys. Plus, Curtis needs four different pieces of equipment, needles, lancets, syringes, and test strips. This equals to $609.93 per month. You can look up those prices on Walgreens' website. He is due to see his doctor this month, but won't go until his work insurance starts. He is 21 years old with no children and should be worrying about getting a date, not worrying about getting medications. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. Let this be the year we stand up and return to being the state that has been admired for taking care of all of our residents. Thank you.
Ms. Tizar, thanks for sharing your story with us. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Jason Stinson. Mr. Stinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Jason Stinson. I'm the owner of Stinson Builders. It's a small residential building and remodeling company. And I'm here to testify or give my endorsement to Senate file number 2. One of the biggest issue as a self-employed or as a small business owner is trying to retain employees. And I've been in business for about 4 years. I have 5 employees. 2 of them are covered under their spouse's insurance. We're currently not able to offer health insurance to our employees, mostly due to the fact that we end up being a small group, and one of my employees has some very minor medical issues that when I've gotten quotes for doing a small group insurance, we end up with premiums from $300 to $400 a month per employee, and that's outside of what we're able to afford at this point. Like I said, I have 5 employees, one of which just has been with me for just over a year and a half. And he just lost his Minnesota, just became ineligible for his Minnesota care. But the story I wanted to share is that as of, I guess it was December, this is a very responsible employee. He started taking personal time in December, asking for Thursday and Friday off, and then he asked for a week off, came in for a week, took another week off. And when I confronted him and said, I'm concerned here. It seems like, is there something going on in your family? Is there something going on here? Are you unhappy working here? I'm concerned about this because you've never done this before. And we sat down and had a good conversation, and he said basically it comes down to the fact that he was trying to do side jobs to make money because he had to renew his eligibility for Minnesota care. Was very concerned because I gave him a raise last year, and we've had a good year, and I've been able to provide consistent work throughout the whole year. He was concerned about losing his Minnesota care and his insurance and going back to being uninsured. And this, to me, is from a business owner perspective. First of all, when I talked to my whole team, I said, okay, this seems to be a big problem. If there's one benefit I could provide to you to keep you guys around, what would it be? And resoundingly, it's always health insurance. So I've checked into, I've contacted the Department of Commerce, talked to Medica, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and we're trying to come up with a plan where we can basically provide some sort of health insurance. But it's very cost prohibitive as a small group. And the other part is that I've talked to other business owners in similar situations where they've had employees where they can't give, who are trapped, basically, good employees who are trapped. They don't want to have a raise because they're going to be ineligible, and their whole family, in some cases, would lose their health insurance. The other thing that Senate File 2 and the buy-in option for small businesses would allow me as a small business owner to do is to become more competitive with some of the bigger companies that have a large enough pool that they can have lower group rates. I currently, due to the downturn in the economy or in the building sector, have acquired a great employee that's been with me for about 4 months, and I'd love to keep him on, but he's made it abundantly clear that because he works for a bigger company, currently does not have health insurance, that's something we can't provide. He's engaged in planning on also wanting to offer insurance to his family. He said that if that company asks for him to come back, he has to go. Even though I can match the wage, that to him is the most important benefit. And that's about it. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Stinson, thanks for your testimony. I know that members of the committee know that you are not alone, and your concerns are shared by many business owners across the state of all sizes.
Thank you. Again.
Next, we'll hear from Rolanda Mason with the St. Cloud Area Legal Services. Ms. Mason, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, good morning. My name is Rolanda Mason. I'm an attorney at St. Cloud Area Legal Services. We serve low-income people in central Minnesota, seven counties in central Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 2, and specifically I want to talk about the simplification of the application process. One of the things that we noticed, as did most of our colleagues around the state, is that many of our clients, the people we serve, are uninsured but eligible for Minnesota Care. So we were concerned about why they weren't receiving Minnesota Care benefits when we knew that they should be eligible for those benefits. We undertook a program where we did outreach and provided direct advocacy to people at all stages of the process. And what we found was that one of the overwhelming barriers that people experienced was the complexity of the application process. And oftentimes, because these are low-income workers, they were not able to go to the local social service office or otherwise take advantage of people in the community who might be able to walk people through applications, and they were struggling with these applications on their own, and they were finding them so difficult that they were giving up. That was confirmed to us by the clinics and the hospitals when we talked to them about the patients that they saw come in who were uninsured and the difficulty they were having helping people get through the application process. And I want to give you an example of a typical client that we saw. There was a woman who was a self-employed farmer, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she needed treatment very, very quickly. And she couldn't get through the application process. She had tried to complete the application for Minnesota Care, and she found it very, very difficult. We were able to come in and help her with that application and get it submitted. One of the other problems was that she needed treatment right away. She needed to have treatment within only a few days. And under the Minnesota Care rules, she was required to submit her application, be approved, and pay her first premium before her eligibility started, and that was a barrier just because it needed to happen so fast. She had no idea on her own how to accelerate that process and to make that happen. Now, luckily, we were able to help her do that. We got her application completed. She was approved for Minnesota Care, and she got the treatment that she needed. But it's a tragedy when people who are diagnosed with a serious, life-threatening illness have to go see a lawyer. She needed to be concentrating on her health care and working with her doctor. She didn't need to be wasting time with someone like me. Minnesota Care should be more easily accessible for people who are eligible, and I think that the provisions in this bill that simplify that application process will make a huge difference for low-income people across the state, and I hope that you keep those provisions in and that the bill moves forward. Thank you.
Ms. Mason, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Laura Dingles. Ms. Dingles, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Laura Dingles. I live at Andrew Residence, a program serving adults like myself who have a mental illness. I have paranoid schizophrenia. I am one of about 145 people at Andrew who have a mental illness, who find ourselves with medication bills we cannot pay. We are being asked to pay co-payments for the cost of our medications with money we do not have. My income consists of Social Security disability insurance. By state rules, any income I have goes to the cost of my care, and I'm limited to a personal needs allowance of $114 a month. That $114 is all I have. It's to buy new shoes, a coat, winter clothing, go to a movie, gifts, buy pop, or anything else I may need. Prior to Medicare Part D, the medications I needed to keep me stable and out of the hospital were completely paid for by the state. Today I'm being charged, one, $265 a year Part D deductible, two, co-payments of 25% for every prescription filled, three, Medicare Part D insurance premiums of $1060 each month. I receive $114 personal needs allowance, and I'm being billed for $355 in deductible premium co-payments for January. Please tell me how to turn $114 into $355. Many people with mental illness do not want to take their medications. I do. It is unwise to prevent persons with mental illness from getting access to medications. Please consider what you are asking of people like me and others with mental illness. Thank you.
Ms. Dingles, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Linda Ferens. Ms. Ferens, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to tell you my story. I am a single mom, and I have two young girls. I'm self-employed, and I run a not-for-profit program that helps kids with mental illness. I'm an equine-assisted psychotherapist, which means it's like big pet therapy, but we use horses to help kids. For the past 4 years, I've been on and off Minnesota Care. My renewal date for every year is October 31st. On October 15th, I get a letter that requests documents, etc. I submit all the documents, copy of birth certificate, copy of driver's license, tax forms, bank statements, but my coverage is repeatedly denied because Minnesota Care is worried about my income since I don't have a statement that shows proof of income. So for the next 5 months, I go without insurance until I'm able to submit the year-end taxes. There's a really sweet pharmacy tech that works at the North St. Paul Target Pharmacy. And she gets tears in her eyes every time I come in and pay $400 a month for my prescriptions. I'm an ovarian cancer survivor, knock on wood. But this Christmas I became very ill and required two blood transfusions. Many, many tests were run, expensive tests, biopsies, ultrasounds, and I learned that I have a tumor on my remaining ovary. I need surgery to remove the tumor, but I can't afford it. So my best bet is to hurry up and get my taxes done, submit those papers to Minnesota Care, reapply, and hopefully get accepted. Thank you very much.
Experience. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for sharing your story. Next, we'll hear from Jonathan Watson with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. Mr. Watson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. Is this on? I hope you can hear me. My name, again, is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, and we have 19 member clinics throughout the state, and we serve about 180,000 Minnesotans. You should have in your packets a one-pager with our logo on the top of it with some data on it just to provide you with a brief overview of our patients. As you can see there, 42% are uninsured, roughly 86% of our patients have incomes below 200% of poverty, and only, 66% of our patients are not white. So we serve a very diverse group of folks throughout the state. Why I'm here today is to support Senate File 2, since many of the provisions would expand health insurance, health care coverage, particularly for uninsured adults. Roughly 44% of the adults we serve do not have insurance. Simplifying the application, eliminating GMC copayments, and increasing Minnesota care eligibility are all things that we support. There are a couple of things in the bill, however, I'd like to direct your attention to. The first one is Section 10, and that does provide a grant program to community health centers throughout Minnesota. Minnesota is one of 15 states that do not provide any support for their community health centers. And they can use these funds for a variety of things. Primary that is just seeing the caring for the increasing numbers of uninsured that we're seeing year to year. Let me just walk through the second handout. It's has our logo, and again, it's sideways. You see the map there with the locations of our clinics. But on slide 3, the most powerful data we have is the numbers of uninsured year to year that is increasing. Since 2001, we've seen about a 45% increase in the number of uninsured folks that we've served, an increase 9% in 2005 alone. In terms with regards to the children, as you see on that chart, the triangle, last year or 2005 over 2004, we saw a very major bump of 24% increase in the number of children we serve. We serve about one out of every four uninsured child in the state and one out of every six uninsured adult. And the question is, why do we attract so many uninsured? And the two answers for that, the two simple answers are our enabling services. On page 4, this compares the costs of services that we have by cost center from the 2003 to 2005 era. And the highest growth are these enabling services. And what these do essentially break down barriers for folks to access health care, particularly the uninsured. They could be language translation services, transportation services. At any rate, we're spending increasing amount of resources on this activity, and we're attracting a lot of patients without any insurance attached to them as a revenue. The last thing, the other piece that is attractive to uninsured patients is the sliding fee schedule. We do charge all uninsured over 100% of poverty based on their income and family size. And as this chart attempts to depict is for every dollar we spend, every cost of uninsured that we incur, patients contribute about 20 cents to that cost. That number has declined over the last 4 or 5 years by 23%. As you can see there in 2001, they contributed roughly 27 cents to every dollar. So we're seeing poorer and poorer patients. You know, these statistics are extremely boring, obviously, but the real world impact of all these statistics are just the following. The Ku Clinic in South Minneapolis closed 22 outreach sites in South Minneapolis. Family health care in Moorhead shut down services last year. 2,500 patients needed to go somewhere else. Westside Clinic, La Clinica in Lake in South Minneapolis shut down services. 5,200 patients needed to find alternative care. Sawtooth Mountain in Tofte, Minnesota suspended services. And Cedar Riverside People's Center in Minneapolis, they recently reduced some of their services, translator services and social workers, and 92% of their patients needed those services, but they had to suspend them for business decisions. So I support the overall goals of Senate File 2, but we'd still need to invest in the infrastructure for access for these folks, and that's what Section 10 does as part of this bill. With me today are a few speakers who can speak to the merits of community health centers and the value they play in their lives. So if I could just turn it over to them at this point. You want me to introduce you? This is Jalissa Rios from Westside Jalissa. Community
yeah,
Health
they
Services.
Could Jessica, but yep. Jalissa.
Ms. Rios, welcome to the committee.
There you go. Thank you so much. Good morning, Madam Chair and member of the committee.
My name is Julissa Rios, and I employ as outreach worker and a case manager at Westside Community Health Services, La Clinica. In my role, I help educate and connect women in the Latino community to breast and cervical cancer screening and ensure that they get the necessary medical follow-up. As a background, I was a new immigrant 13 years ago from Peru, South America. I came with a five-year-old boy with no English, no nothing. In the winter, from a hot weather, it was a shocking experience. And like every immigrant who came to Minnesota, I got my health care at the clinica. As you arrive to a new country and a new city, you don't have a health insurance, and you don't have no place to go when you have a child. You know they will get sick. And the clinica was a welcoming place for me and my family. And my dream was one day to pay the clinic back. This is what I'm working now with my community and with the clinic because they helped me a lot as an immigrant at the time. Not just the doctors and the nurses who spoke my own language. Everybody there was really helpful. And until I became accustomed to Minnesota and I learned English and became employed. And now I'm proud of the work the clinic does on behalf of new immigrants and refugees in making sure that everyone gets early and preventing care. Today, I want to share a story with you about Enedina, who is here with me. And I got to know Enedina after her baby was born. She came to the clinic for follow-up because of a breast lump. I accompanied her for the breast ultrasound scheduled at Regent Hospital to rule out problems. She told me she was a single mom, her older daughter was 11, and the baby was 9 months old at the time. She was living with relatives and babysitting for older children to have some income. Shortly after the ultrasound was done, the doctor asked me if she can stay for a biopsy. I stayed with her for the biopsy, and during the biopsy, after the doctor compared some things, when a really an emotional voice, he told me, "Could you please tell the patient that she has cancer?" I have to tell you that cancer is the same word in Spanish and English. I didn't need to translate that word. I turned my head and I looked in Edina's eyes and I tried to sound the care as possible and say, "The doctor thinks you may have cancer." And she started crying for a period of time. And I still remember she turned, looked at me, and she said, "I will be able to still nursing my baby." This was her first question. It was not about her. It was about her baby. "I will be able to still nursing my baby." And I asked the doctor, and the doctor said no. This is when she started crying more because she was worried about nursing her baby. She didn't understand the meaning of having breast cancer, the meaning of the treatment, getting medical care. She didn't understand the part. She was caring about her baby. And that was really, really sad for me. I reviewed everything again with her. I knew her lack of health insurance could delay things. And I offered to schedule an appointment with a social worker. I gave her some helpful information in Spanish to read. And I tried to ask her questions to assess how much she understood about the diagnosis. It was really difficult for me to understand that after two attempts to explain, she was still not getting the full meaning of having breast cancer. She will need chemo and then surgery and then radiation. And I knew this could be a long process for a single mom who is the only income of her family. She does not speak English and she does not drive. We talk again, I show her pictures, and finally help her to understand what was truly happening to her. She cried a lot and a lot, and after a while, we talk about the possibility of a bright future, a help for her family. We talk about the things will be better. There was a help in the community for her. I connect her with help for transportation, wigs, and prosthesis. Finding babysitter was a big problem. She did not have health insurance for herself since her pregnancy.
Her doctor at the clinic had to write a letter appealing for emergency medical coverage so that she could get the treatment needed to save her life. The language barrier, lack of understanding about how insurance worked, and the administrative requirements were overwhelming to her withdrawal assistant. Now she's recovering after receiving the necessary treatment. She has a very positive attitude, and she's looking forward to a happy future. She continued getting her follow-up care at the clinic. She needs to keep healthy despite that she's not eligible for ongoing medical coverage. I have to tell you that my job gives me the opportunity to know the needs of the community, the faces of the community that no one sees. Being an immigrant with little, no knowledge about cancer, mammograms, chemo, prosthesis, about prevention of Western medicine or health insurance, with limited English and often limiting writing and reading skill, even in own language, make life really difficult. A lot of immigrants, they cannot even write and read in Spanish. Having a medical home is critical for new immigrants like Enedina, who face some of the widest disparities in health status, in access to care, and in a quality care receiving. For me and for Enedina, the home is La Clinica. Now, Enedina will say some words, and I will translate for you guys. Thank you.
And Dina, welcome to the committee.
Okay. En el 2005, a mí me detectaron cáncer de seno.
In 2005, I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Y pues yo tuve que acudir a la clínica.
The first thing I did was asking for help at the clinic.
Y de la clínica del Westside, pues ellos me mandaron al Regions a hacerme un mamograma.
Westside Clinic sent me to Regions for a mammogram.
Y pues yo pienso que gente pues que estamos aquí en este país, que no tenemos a dónde acudir, y pues lo primero que hacemos es ir a la clínica del Westside.
Everybody who comes here as an immigrant, we don't have a place to go. The only place we have is La Clinica.
Y pues yo ahorita hasta la fecha, yo estoy yendo con mi doctora de cabecera, que es Susan Belfion.
I'm still going to the clinic to see Dr. Manfield.
Y pues mis otras citas las tengo en el Regions.
I am still having appointments in Regions.
Pero seguro no tengo.
But I probably not gonna go because I don't have health insurance.
I don't know. Yo pienso que ya es todo.
She said that's it.
And Dina, thank you for sharing your story with us today, for coming here.
You're welcome.
And this is Eric. He was 9 months old when mom was detected with cancer, and now he's running around with a healthy mom. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Mr. Watson, do you have an additional testifier with you?
Yes, I
think
I have two more.
Okay.
Good morning.
Connie Walsh with United Family Practice. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Walsh.
Thank you, and good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about those members of our community who are uninsured and underinsured. My name is Connie Walsh, and currently I'm the lead patient advocate at United Family Practice Health Center. We're located just 5 minutes from here in the West 7th area of St. Paul. United Family Practice is a federally qualified look-alike community health center, health clinic. For the past 35 years, I've worked in healthcare as a nurse, and for the last 15, as a patient advocate. As you're well aware, statistics provided by the Minnesota Department of Health in July of 2006 tell us that there are 383,000 Minnesotans without healthcare coverage. Last year, our clinic saw 12,000 patients, and 3,348 of them were new patients. When a new patient arrives, nearly one-third of them are uninsured. Last month alone, my staff and I saw 130 individuals and families that presented with no health care. Less than 7% qualified for medical assistance, and another 7% had household incomes that exceeded our sliding fee scale. So what happens to those approximately 86% in the middle? They were screened and are paying anywhere from $20 a visit to a 25% discount for care provided by our staff. But that doesn't include medications, lab work, health education, and equipment. As important as all those numbers are, I'd like to give them a face by introducing you to two of our patients and their families. Tim is 24. He's single. He's a white male college graduate working two part-time jobs. Neither provide health insurance. His gross household income is $1,400 a month, which gives him a 25% discount for care based on federal poverty guidelines. He is paying $700 a month for rent, paying off his college loans, and drives a second-hand truck to work. Tim is a new patient to the clinic, and he can no longer afford to go to the clinic that he had been seen in the past, and the diabetic specialist he's need to see when his health insurance ran out. They would no longer renew his meds, even if he could afford them without an office visit and lab work. Tim's blood sugars in the office were high, and when asked what they had been running in the past few weeks, he admitted he couldn't afford the equipment, and his blood glucose monitor was broken. His office visit and blood test with the discount was $146. A new glucose monitor would have been $69, but we were able to give him a free monitor provided by a pharmaceutical company. However, a month's worth of testing scripts and equipment runs about $125 a month. His meds run another $125 if he could stay on oral medication, but the picture will change dramatically if he needs to go on insulin. We were able to find discounts for his meds, but even with all those discounts, coupons, connections we have in the community, we can approximate that his yearly expenditure for medications alone would be $2,500. He has applied for Minnesota Care 4 months ago and has not heard anything from them yet. Another family scenario. The Jones family have been patients of United Family for years. This family is intact, with a mom, a dad, four school-age children ranging in age from 5 to 16 years of age. Dad works in construction as a tile man, and mom is a stay-at-home mom doing some of the occasional sewing for a little added income, but sees herself as the scout leader, taxi driver, and she says, the general domestic goddess. Dad was laid off in November due to the slowdown in construction. Dad could not afford COBRA payments and a mortgage. The family thought that this would just be a temporary situation. But after 3 months, the family savings were gone, and mom had started to work a full-time job in a factory, second shift for $11 an hour with no benefits because she is considered a contract employee. Last month, three of the kids came down with strep throat and were seen in the clinic. The family was screened and qualified for a sliding fee at the lowest step, or $20 a visit. Because we were able to do the strep cultures in our in-house lab, the cost of their out-of-pocket expenses were $20. If the family was seen at an urgent care or a convenience care clinic, the visit easily would have been $80 to $100 plus medication. We were able to send the family with a prescription for medication, and they paid $4 because of a program now at Target. We also screened the family, and they are now receiving Fare for All, a food program for low-income families to bulk purchase groceries as well as energy assistance. These are just some of the slide care or non-reimbursable care provided by the staff at United Family Practice and other community clinics. This family would not have qualified for Minnesota Care because, at the time, they had not been uninsured for 4 months, and the family income for last year exceeded the Minnesota Care levels. As you can see by these two scenarios, this could have happened to any of us sitting here or members of our family. We need to consider how we meet the needs of those in our community who are working and do need to respectfully provide for themselves and their family. For this reason and many more, we support the passage of Senate File Number 2.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walsh. Mr. Palmore, Stephen Palmore.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Finance, Health, and Human Service Committee. I'm grateful for this opportunity to appear before you today to share some of my experiences in trying to maintain adequate health insurance for me and to state my full support for this committee's effort to expand the eligibility for Minnesota Care. My name is Stephen Palmore, and I live in Minneapolis. I'm currently employed at North Point Health and Wellness Center, Incorporated in North Minneapolis, as a community health care worker. I've been in this position for 10 months. Prior to this job, I was unemployed for a little under a year. During this time, I received $1,000 per month in unemployment benefits. This amount fell short of covering my basic living expenses of $1,600 a month. A great portion of my expenses went toward health care. I used to pay health insurance through COBRA because I didn't qualify for Minnesota Care. I did not qualify for Minnesota Care because of the amount of money I received from unemployment. Therefore, I was forced to purchase COBRA. So I was in a difficult situation because my unemployment did not cover my basic expenses, yet it was considered too much money and therefore eliminated me from being eligible for Minnesota Care. My monthly cost for COBRA was $490 per month in addition to $10 copay visits. Also included in my monthly expenses was the financial support I was providing for my son, who was enrolled at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois. I wanted to ensure my son was able to receive a college degree and did not want my financial problems to interfere with that important goal. I used practically all the little money I had saved to make up the difference between what I took in from unemployment and my total monthly expenses. During that year, I made about 20 visits to a physician or healthcare clinic due to the number of chronic conditions, including scoliosis and a slipped disc. I also experienced some orthopedic injuries, which included a bulging disc in my neck and minor knee injuries due to sports. I also regularly took medications for high cholesterol and skin ailments. The payment to COBRA over a year's time just about exhausted the little funds I put away in savings. Fortunately, I landed a position at North Point Health and Wellness Center before I completely spent every dime in my possession. Today, I'm fortunate I have a position that provides health care insurance as part of my benefit package and that I'm earning a salary that I would gradually be able to replenish my savings account. I'm happy to support this committee's effort to expand the eligibility for Minnesota Care that will hopefully save others from facing personal bankruptcy as I did in order to maintain adequate health insurance for me. Thank you again for allowing me to speak to you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Mr. Palmore, thank you for your testimony today. Mr. Watson, thank you very much. Before we continue, I just want to remind testifiers of two things. One, we do have a long list of testifiers today, so if you could be brief in your comments, that would be appreciated. And I've been asked to remind everyone to be sure to sign your name and contact information on the paper at the table. And with that, we will continue with Christine Stone. Ms. Stone, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of prescription drug provisions included in Senator Berglund's Senate File 2. My name is Christine Stone, a volunteer with AARP Minnesota, representing nearly 675,000 people throughout the state. AARP supports reducing the cost of prescription drugs for Minnesotans of all ages. We believe it makes common sense to harness the purchasing power of consumers and the state to bring down drug prices. Despite efforts of the federal level to lower costs through the new Medicare drug benefit and efforts here in Minnesota to help consumers obtain lower-cost prescription drugs, the fact remains that prescription drugs prices for Minnesota consumers are still rising, and some consumers under the age of 65 are still without coverage. AARP supports the drug discount program included in Senate File 2. This provision is important for the many Minnesotans of all ages who have no drug coverage and are forced to pay out of pocket for their prescriptions. My daughter is a good example of that. She was a nurse who injured her back working in a ventilator. She was working in a home where they have patients on ventilators. The aide didn't show up, and she tried to turn a patient who was too heavy. And so she ruptured two discs. After she got out and was able to go back to work, she's a nurse, and she had a pre-existing back injury and was unable to find affordable insurance, so she had to get catastrophic coverage, which doesn't cover any prescription drugs. She was already financially strained from the other, and it was a struggle to pay for those drugs. Many family members, like my daughter, would benefit from the ability to pay the Medicaid rate of drugs in this bill. We also support the provision in the bill that would allow those with Medicare Part D drug coverage to purchase drugs at the Medicaid rate that are not covered under their Part D plan, are drugs that are purchased when the individual is responsible for 100% of the cost of drugs. These provisions would affect many low-income seniors and people with disabilities who have very little income and for whom a copay is a big expense. And being a senior myself, I can tell you I hear a lot of stories from people who can't afford their prescriptions. AARP research shows that prices for the most commonly used drugs continue to outpace inflation year after year, and that's one of the big complaints I hear. My drugs are going up even though I'm on the Medicare Part D. AARP strongly believes that this legislation will be a step toward truly making a difference in the pocketbooks of those who continue to struggle to pay their medication. Thank you.
Ms. Stone, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Next, we'll hear from Michael Scandrett with the Safety Net Coalition. Mr. Scandrett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Michael Belzer is also going to come up to the table and help us present on behalf of the Safety Net Coalition.
Dr. Belzer, welcome.
My name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. And the coalition is a group of six different organizations whose primary mission is serving low-income and uninsured Minnesotans. And we've come together to come to you to bring the message that because of the rapid growth in the number of uninsured people and the decline in eligibility for public programs, the safety net, which we often assume is the last resort that will be there if people aren't able to get coverage or to get health care through traditional health care providers, can go to the safety net. But the safety net providers are reaching a tipping point. And as Jonathan Watson spoke to you earlier about, some of the clinics have already had to go out of business, unable to keep pace, and others are getting close to that point. And while the coalition's primary goal would be to see that all people are insured, the reality is that if we get there, it will take a while, and that probably whatever happens this session will not get us all the way there. And in the meantime, the safety net coalition providers are going to have trouble serving those uninsured that remain in the system. So we have several things we appreciate that are included in the bill. Again, the expansion of eligibility for Minnesota Care is important. The other provisions in the bill that would improve the enrollment process and simplify the process of those who are already eligible to get coverage. The support for the critical access dental program, the outreach programs in the bill, the amendment that would provide coverage for community health worker programs that are used by the clinics in order to provide service to those often who aren't able to speak English or who require additional non-healthcare services in order for them to be able to get the healthcare that they need. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Michael Belzer from Hennepin County Medical Center to talk about Hennepin County's experience.
Dr. Belzer, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Michael Belzer, and for the past 18 years, I've been the medical director at Hennepin County Medical Center. And I'm here this morning to lend our voice to the support of Senate File 2. Let me start by a question, and that question is, what happens to patients when they lose their health insurance coverage, or it's taken away as so happened to so many Minnesotans as a consequence of the last legislative session? Well, let me tell you what they don't do. They don't call their broker. They don't call Medica or Health Partners and Blue Cross Blue Shield and ask to sign up for an $8,000 to $10,000 policy. No, they go uninsured. Uninsurance is a disease. Unlike what many would have us believe, it's not merely an inconvenience of having to wait longer in a public clinic or in a public hospital like Hennepin County Medical Center with crowded waiting rooms. Uninsurance is a very serious disease with fatal health consequences. The uninsured are sicker. The uninsured have worse health status at every age. And the uninsured die prematurely. It's estimated that from long-term studies, the chances of dying from certain common medical conditions is 25% greater in the uninsured population than in the insured population. The prestigious Institute of Medicine calculated that 18,000 to 20,000 individuals died in 2001 due directly to the lack of health insurance. A more recent study from Harvard Medical School in 2004 estimated that over 100,000 U.S. residents would die in the ensuing 8 years, specifically because they lacked health insurance. And they go on to predict that it's only likely to increase with the growing older of the baby boomers. I ask you if this is a existing eligibility and benefit cut policy we want to support in Minnesota, and is this the role of state government? The legislation contains several aspects worthy of our support at Hennepin County Medical Center, but none more important than the one I spoke to, which is the extension or restoration of public program insurance coverage for a recently estimated 51,000 Minnesotans, including single adults, children, and families. In our institution at Hennepin County Medical Center, we provided care to over 38,000 individuals without identifiable health insurance, and from 2004 to 2006, that increased over 29%. Our uninsured visits, like patients, increased a similar 31% to 157,000 visits in 2006. The uncompensated care costs, and that's not charges, many of the graphs you've seen today show charges, our cost at the medical center over that three-year time frame is almost $100 million. The level of the cost of the uninsured and the rising cost of their care has obviously placed considerable strain on our medical center. It's prevented us from expanding and improving programs, inhibited facility upgrades, and increased property tax liability for Hennepin County businesses and residential properties, even though we provide many millions of dollars of care to state residents from outside Hennepin County. So whether it's the outreach efforts of the uninsured or the expansion of the dental providers, exempting children from citizenship requirements, or steering patients to the most appropriate health care providers, or incentives to manage care better, Hennepin County Medical Center strongly supports Senate File 2, and we wish to extend our appreciation to Senator Berglund and the co-authors of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, on both of you, for your testimony. At this time, I'll call up Tony Schmitz and Pam White. Tony Schmitz with the Healthcare Education Industry Partnership, Pam White, North Point Health and Wellness Center. Mr. Schmitz and Ms. White, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm here to speak briefly about the cost effectiveness of employing community health workers in care coordination and patient education. But blessedly, I'm here with Pam White and Stella Whitney West, who are with North Point, who can first explain what community health workers do on the day-to-day and how they help the patients they see.
Good morning. My name is Pam White, and I'm the Director of Community Health Outreach for North Point Health and Wellness Center, which is a community health center located in North Minneapolis. I'm honored to be here this morning to have the opportunity to appear before you to share my experience as an employer of community health workers and to state my full support for this committee's efforts to cover certain services provided by community health workers. North Point has employed community health workers since 2005. We started with two full-time community health workers and now employ 11. We have a partnership with Minneapolis Community Technical College to offer community health worker classes on site. We also are an internship site for community health workers and have been that site for the past 2 years and have had 32 students have their 32 students go through their internship at our location. Our community health workers are from the community. They share a lot of psychosocial and other issues as the patients they serve. Community health workers are lay health professionals that advocate on the behalf of those that do not understand how to navigate the healthcare and human service systems. Community health workers build relationships with patients and community residents through outreach activities in senior high-rises, health fairs, schools, churches, and other community events. They provide health education to meet the diverse needs of the community. They also provide prevention education, including screenings, including blood pressure, cholesterol, and glucose screenings. They provide intervention and lifestyle counseling for patients with chronic diseases and other illnesses. They also develop individual care plans that are coordinated with the patient and provider's input. Community health workers at North Point have worked in the following areas: prenatal care, newborn care, parenting classes, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, immunizations, senior health, women's health, HIV and STI education, tobacco cessation, and secondhand smoke. In 2006, the Community Health Worker Department served 4,358 households. They also made contact with 8,123 total individuals. 1,916 patients were able to access North Point's medical and human services, and 1,849 individuals were provided with health education information. In closing, community health workers are unique and valuable to the healthcare system. They not only provide advocacy, navigation, and outreach, they play an instrumental role in preventative care and providing education and care coordination that improves the health outcome for people living with chronic diseases.
Thank you, Ms. White.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Stella Whitney West, and I'm Chief Operations Officer for North Point Health and Wellness Center. And you just heard Pam White, who is a nurse practitioner, talk about how we utilize community health workers at North Point. I'd just like to add that we're able to fund our community health worker program through grants. And the concern is that with grant funding, there's no long-term sustainability. What this Senate File 2 would allow us to do is to bill for these valuable services that community health workers provide. And being able to bill for these services would then ensure that community health workers will be ongoing and part of the medical care provider. So we're here to support Senate File 2. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If I could just add,
Mr. Schmitz,
to the end here, this is one of those happy instances where it costs you something, but you save a little bit more. There's a increasing body of scientific evidence that shows that when you send community health workers into the community, when they're talking to patients who have chronic conditions that need to have explained to them how to take their medicine, how to take care of their feet, their eyes with diabetes, what you get are fewer visits to the emergency room, more scheduled visits to a physician, less cost in the end. In Denver, a study showed that with 590 patients, male patients who were coming in for treatment as public clients, a return on investment of 2.28 to 1. If you spent a dollar on community health workers, you saved $2.28. Similarly, a study in Baltimore of diabetes patients showed you save $2,200 a year on their treatment. Here we've had preliminary discussions with DHS where workers there have said, we're willing to accept the premise of the cost savings of this return on investment, just to err on the side of caution rather than saying if you spend a dollar on community health workers, we'll save $2.28. They're saying, let's say that we'll save $1.14. But it still means that if you fund our estimate of 400 community health workers, you spend $7 million in a year, but you save $8 million. You know, it's an investment that pays off in the end. So thank you very much for your time.
Right. Mr. Schmitz, Ms. White, and Ms. Whitney West, again, thank you for your testimony. Yiska Bracca, with the Center for Urban Health at Hennepin County Medical Center. Ms. Bracca, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, and thanks for hearing me. I'm the research director for the Center for Urban Health. We're located at Hennepin County Medical Center. We're a relatively new organization, and our mission statement is to improve and sustain the health of diverse urban populations, although Minnesota as a whole, the state, is becoming increasingly diverse. And I won't take up much of your time here. I'm speaking about the amendment that you adopted earlier, A31, which would provide us with the startup capacity to evaluate on a long-term basis some of the programs that are embedded within this bill that you have before you. For example, the people that just preceded me were talking about the cost savings overall to the state that could come from supporting community health workers. We don't have right now in the state the capacity to actually evaluate this directly for everybody. And we would like to build that capacity so that a couple years from now, if this issue comes up again before this or a reconfigured committee, we'll actually have the data to look at it. The people who are sitting around this room in a few years may not be here, the ones today. They may not have heard the testimony today, and it's just going to be a continuing education process and information process. So we fully support Senate File 2, and I particularly urge you to keep in mind that we're going to need future data information to evaluate these programs in the future. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bracca, for your testimony today. Next, we will hear from Jim Koppel, if he's, thank you. Okay. Mr. Koppel with the Children's Defense Fund, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm here also. You can remove one name further down your list for Carol Spector from the Children's Defense Fund as well. I think you only need to hear us once today. The Children's Defense Fund is a nonprofit organization advocating for children across Minnesota. We've long been involved in the healthcare debate, and I just want to lend our support to Senate File 2 and say the following. You know, 1992, I had a different employer, but I was part of the capital atmosphere that passed Minnesota Care. And prior to that, part of an atmosphere that passed the Children's Health Plan in the late 80s, and we were the first state in the country to pass a Children's Health Plan. We were the first state in the country to pass a bill as comprehensive as Minnesota Care, which not only covered the promise of coverage to every single person in Minnesota by July 1st of 1998, but also was to start out at 275% of poverty for every eligibility, not just for families with children, but also for single adults. It didn't take us long to break many of those promises, another which was that all of the money in the Health Care Access Fund would be used to cover the uninsured, which was came from hospitals and doctors and chiropractors and all the provider community. And we broke that promise, and we have probably taken $1 billion out of that Health Care Access Fund over the years. We just took, we're in the process of taking $100 million out and a $200-plus million biennium that we're in right now that should never have been touched. And if that money was available and had been used, we wouldn't be sitting here today to decide to go incrementally to the next step in this process. However, that's where we're at, and I just want to say that not only should we be looking at moving adults to 200% of poverty, doing away with so many of the barriers that children face in their families in health care, we should continue to look at the vision that was created when we passed the Children's Health Plan, when we passed Minnesota Care initially, and what we wanted to do in this state was to get to universal coverage. I think the bill has many great contributions to that. We, from our perspective, would love to see more done for children. However, with the presumptive eligibility, with removal of insurance barriers, removal of employer-based coverage as another one of the barriers to many of the children that are eligible for health care and not using it, I think the biggest barrier left in this bill, while it's reduced, would be premiums. And those will always get in the way of working families in their efforts to keep health care coverage. As long as we have premiums, they take a fair chunk of income, you know, families struggle, and I think that's going to be the biggest barrier left in this bill. Of course, the additional as I see in the amendments today, presumptive eligibility will go a long way. If I was going to have a list of add-ons, certainly that would have been one of them. And the simplest possible paperwork, I think this 24-page application we have today, if we can get that back to 4 pages that it was 4 years ago, we would go a long way in making Minnesota Care more accessible. I'd like to give you one other piece of information along that line. In 1998, the application was 25 pages long. In 1999, it was reduced by Governor Ventura's administration to 4 pages. Beginning in 1999, we had more people enroll every month for the next 2 years than we had in any previous month for the past 5 years before that. And so if paperwork, someone says paperwork doesn't make a difference, it makes a huge difference. And so if we can get rid of some of these barriers, which means getting rid of paperwork, including asset tests, which families shouldn't have to spend on their assets to get health care, if we can continue to push and reduce these barriers, we reduce paperwork as well, and ultimately the administrative costs. So I applaud Senator Berglund's efforts in pushing this bill forward as the first step. And we have a ways to go, and we have a ways to catch up from the promises we made in 1992. But this is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Mr. Koppel, thanks for your testimony. We will now hear from Twyla Braze.
Good
Ms. Braze, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. You took me out of line, and so I wasn't quite ready.
But here we go.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I wonder if I could ask just one question before I start. The fiscal note just was delivered here, and it seems to be limited to the programs, Minnesota Care, et cetera. Do you know if there will be a fiscal note on the electronic medical records piece or any other piece of the bill?
Ms. Braze, after the testimony concludes, then we're going to be discussing the fiscal note in further detail.
Great. Thank you so much.
Ms. Braze.
One thing that I would like to start with after seeing the fiscal note is that it looks to be that the cost to the state is up to about $133 million more for this bill, which I would just like to make a comment that what that means is that cost is always borne by taxpayers. And what that could mean for taxpayers who are currently insured is that it makes it more difficult for them to stay insured, and therefore that could lead to an expanded rate of uninsurance and therefore a call for even greater expansion of the eligibility programs that we have here today. I'd also like to make a comment about some of the testimony that you have heard already this morning, in that I think it would have been useful perhaps to just have asked some of those people with those stories, which indeed are difficult to listen to, but would they not prefer, I mean, why were they here? They were here because they are dependent on the state for coverage. Would they not prefer to be not vulnerable to the decisions that are made around this table, to the decisions that are made according to budgets and to politics and to policymakers? Would they not prefer to have and own their own policy and not be dependent? But yet what I see with this bill is that it's going to expand coverage through the state and making, therefore, more people vulnerable to the decisions that are made around this table. So that's the first thing that I'd like to say when it comes to this bill and what it will do for spending and what it means for finance and what it means for people. The other thing that I would like to talk about is the electronic medical records. And nothing has been said this morning about that piece, and this is the Finance Committee. And so I'd like to just bring to your attention that according to Health Affairs, it costs $44,000 for that system to be implemented in a doctor's office, and that's per doctor, and $8,500 every year for maintenance. That's an enormous expense, and it will add to the cost of healthcare for individuals. Right now, only 6 to 15% of clinics are implementing this system, and so what this bill is essentially is an unfunded mandate, a requirement that a lot of money be spent for something that they are not spending money for today. Health East has had a presentation for the eHealth Committee, and sorry, I just didn't have it out here. And if there's someone who can take this around, I'm happy to give it, but I'll also just show it to you sort of as a photo here, is what they say as one of the challenges and barriers to health IT today are these $7 marks here, money, lots and lots of money. And so this bill represents an unfunded mandate and will require more money to be spent. And when you look at what Stratus Health said in a 2004 presentation, they said that for every dollar that the provider, the doctor, spends to create the system or to create the medical records, there's only 11 cents of savings to the provider and 89 cents to the payers, employers, patient. Health East notes in a different, in another screen in this PowerPoint, that it is health plans, not clinics, that are the beneficiaries of health IT. And so, therefore, you essentially are saving more money for those who are charging us more. One thing that I don't see in this bill, and I would love to see in this bill, is a way to open up this market. Right now, the top three or the most dominant three health plans have 45, 85% of the population in their plans, which means that they control access to health care, limit access to health care, and can increase significantly the cost of premiums every year because people have nowhere to go. Of course, that means that health care is more expensive. And I find it interesting that we don't have traditional health insurance today in this state because of changes that were made in 1992. And the Department of Commerce in 2000 said that about 50% of the health insurance companies had left the state as a result of those changes that were made in 1992. Therefore, we do not have much access today to traditional health insurance, which is a protection against assets. Instead, what we have is prepaid health care, which is very expensive and requires every health care expense from sniffly nose to comatose patient to go through the health insurance company. And every time that happens, hands take out more money, and it is more expensive. And what I'd love to see in this bill is an opening up of the market and a move to more traditional, less expensive health insurance so that more people would be insured. Rather than having the mandate that we have in here for the electronic medical records, rather than having the expensive reporting system that's required in here as well. So that's the concerns that I bring to you, that this is, as the fiscal note notes, this is going to be an extremely high cost for the taxpayers of the state, and the electronic medical records will as well be intrusive, which I have mentioned in the policy committees before. So thank you very much.
Ms. Brace, thank you for your testimony today. At this time, I'd like to call Phil Stahlberger of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil Stahlberger with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm going to shorten my testimony and condense my testimony to include that of Julie Bruner, who I think is number 26 on your list. With that, I do want to commend Senator Berglund and thank Senator Berglund for her continued efforts to get more people covered in Minnesota. Blue Cross Blue Shield supports many of the provisions included in Senate File 2. We are pleased that language is included to increase eligibility for government health care programs and reduce barriers to health care access. In particular, in Senate File 2, we support increasing coverage to children and families, allowing up to the age 25 to remain on their parents' policy in Sections 1 and 7 is of particular importance to us. It does reduce some administrative burden and can get more of those that age group coverage. We support allowing the 12-month continuous eligibility of Minnesota Care in Section 24. We also support limiting the co-pays for the GAMC program. We support the increase in the hospital benefit under Minnesota Care from $10,000 to $20,000. We also support the language to expand and improve outreach so that more people who are eligible can be enrolled. And finally, we do support the goal of universal coverage by 2010 and the use of the Legislative Commission to craft the next phase of healthcare reform to achieve universal coverage here in Minnesota. We hope that we and other stakeholders can continue to be a part of that process. I think that's some of the quickest testimony I've given all session. I'll hand the rest over to Ms. Bruner.
Mr. Stahlberg, the committee appreciates that. Ms. Bruner, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'll try to keep this rolling here. I'm Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee today. We have followed this bill through all of the committees that it's been in to date, and I've testified in most of those committees. And I want to reiterate our appreciation for the work that Senator Berglund is doing. This is a very exciting direction to go, and we're very pleased with the expansion. I think the testimony that you heard this morning, while difficult to hear, really makes the case for the need to make changes, and we really endorse, and I second what Mr. Stahlberger just said. The increase in the hospital benefit rate from $10,000 to $20,000 is something that we continue to really want to stress our support for. It's been a long time since that's been increased, and we think it's a good policy direction. I want to focus my concern on one particular issue this morning, and that's in Section 47 of the bill that allows small employers to purchase coverage for their employees through Minnesota Care. Health plans have been active in their work in covering individuals in Minnesota care for a number of years. And we understand and appreciate the goal that Senator Berglund has for trying to make health care more accessible for small employers. So we support what her goal is. Erasing the $20,000 inpatient limit, as I said, is something that we support. But by using the health care access fund to pay for costs in excess of the $20,000 means that those costs are not going to be accurately reflected in whatever the Minnesota care premium looks like to the employer who's purchasing it. So it will be a distortion of what the real costs are because there'll be a subsidy from the health care access fund that won't be reflected in the premium. One of the problems is that the small employers who do not choose to go and purchase through Minnesota Care but purchase on the private market pay the 1% premium tax into the health care access fund. So those employers will be subsidizing employers who do choose to participate in the Minnesota Care program. We believe that it will create sort of two tiers or a distortion in what the real costs of health care are. If the health care access fund is going to be subsidizing some of the costs for Minnesota care and small employers purchasing that won't know exactly or won't appreciate what the real costs of health care are. Employers who continue to purchase on the private market will be paying whatever the real premium is, and they will also be participating or contributing that 1% premium tax into the health care access fund. So we believe what it does is it creates a false impression of what healthcare costs really are. Minnesota has not merged the public and the private markets in this way in the past. Our position is that this is not a good direction to go. We believe that there are other ways to create affordable health care for small employers, and we hope that we can continue to work with Senator Berglund as the bill moves through to try to enhance some of those opportunities. All right. Thank you.
Ms. Bruner, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Stahlberger, thank you for your testimony. And at this time, I'd like to call Senator Berglund back to the table. And members, we've heard a lot of testimony on various parts of the bill this morning, and I think much of the testimony is reflective of certainly the parameters and the degree of work that Senator Berglund has put into pulling this together. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the division, I think that the latest fiscal note does not include a number of the amendments that were offered this morning, and so we will see the fiscal note changing. In a few areas it might go up a little bit, and in one area we think it'll go down a lot. And why don't I have Mr. Godfrey explain that item to you.
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, members, there's one provision in this bill. It begins on Section 28. It's extending the transitional period for the GAMC transitional Minnesota care population from 6 months to 12-month eligibility period. And in doing that, the department had assumed, based on the original language, that those individuals in transitional Minnesota care would continue to be enrolled in the program with their premiums subsidized by the Department of Human Services. They would not have to pay a premium, basically. Because of that assumption, it assumed that 11,000 people per year would stay in that program that wouldn't otherwise. And by doing that, it created a huge cost for the Healthcare Access Fund portion of this fiscal note. And it more or less averages out over the course of the 4 years to about $100 million a year. So based on new language that was adopted today, I believe, the enrollees in the transitional Minnesota Care program would have a 12-month eligibility period and renewal, but they would still have to begin paying premiums at the sixth-month mark. And we think, based on our conversations with the department, that that eliminates, if not all, most of the cost. And if you do that, and I can summarize quickly what the fiscal note for the Healthcare Access Fund would be if we did take that portion of the bill out. I'll do that quickly just so folks have that. But for fiscal year 08, if we eliminated that cost, the Healthcare Access Fund spending would be $20.5 million. In 09, it would be $83.9 million. In fiscal year 10, it would be $132 million. And in fiscal year 11, it would be $156.3 million. And once you account for that, that significant cost, the cost of the fund, the cost of the bill does fit within the surplus that is available in the Healthcare Access Fund.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. Senator Berglund.
And then, Madam Chair, if you want to turn to page 36 of
Madam
the fiscal
Chair.
Note.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
I have a question about the previous section. I don't know, maybe Senator Berglund can answer. I don't understand the piece about paying the premium starting at the sixth month.
Senator
Madam
Berglund.
Chair and Senator Prentner-Solon, when we decided that we wanted people who are in general assistance medical care to get a medical home and not just go off the program once they got better and started working again, but to be phased into Minnesota care, we had a six-month period, 4 months where they're on general assistance medical care, and then 6 months where they move into Minnesota care and they do not pay premiums. The assumption in the fiscal note was that with the annual eligibility that they would not pay premiums for a year. That was never my intention. My intention was that they don't have to reapply, just as the other people in the bill are not going to be reapplying. They're only going to be reapplying annually. But that the transition period for them to have this health care without premiums would end. The counties are paying their premiums for the first 6 months. After that, they would then understand that they are to become responsible for paying the premiums.
Okay.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
And Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, so what this does is actually reduce the cost for 2008 and 2009, but increases it for ongoing bienniums. And what you're saying is that is accounted for in the Healthcare Access Fund?
Well, with the amendment of not assuming that these premiums are paid for this group for a year, that reduces the assumptions in the fiscal note for that portion.
But, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the numbers that Mr. Giel gave us, or Mr. Godfrey gave us, rather, are higher for 2010 and 2011, actually.
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, I'll just reiterate the numbers again for 10 and 11. The new number for the Healthcare Access Fund, in this fiscal note, it's at $238 million total. In the with the revised language, it would be $132 million. And then in fiscal year 11, instead of $269 million, it would be $156 million.
Okay, obviously I'm looking at the wrong reference here then. Oh.
If you look down on the spreadsheet, basically the first part of the spreadsheet where it says total cost to the state,
okay.
I'm sorry, you look at the line that says net costs and then in parentheses savings.
Mr. Godfrey, what page are you on?
I'm sorry, this is the very first page of the fiscal note.
Okay.
You'll see a line that says fund-HCAF. That's the total cost of the Healthcare Access Fund, the net cost okay. of the bill.
Okay.
And so the numbers I gave you would replace those numbers.
Get those numbers, please. Okay. Senator Madam Chair. Rosen.
Mr. Godfrey, could you repeat the numbers again
sure.
for us?
Mr. Godfrey.
Again, beginning in fiscal year 08, the Healthcare Access Fund amount would be $20.5 million. In fiscal year 09, it would be just under $84 million or $83.9 million. In fiscal year 10, it's $131.9 million. And then in fiscal year 11, it's $156.3
million. And members, when we get a new fiscal note on this, we'll make sure you all get it. So, but that does give you a little bit of a rough idea of how the fiscal note would be changing. Then if you look on page 36 of the fiscal note, it shows you over the four-year period the growth in enrollment that is projected. And we expect that growth in enrollment would be about 10,000 less because of this change.
36. That's on page 36, members. Senator Berglund.
So instead of talking about almost 62,000 more insured people, we'd be talking about almost 52,000 new insured people. And the numbers that we had showed about 10,000 of those would be adults without children, about 10,000 would be parents, and the rest would be children. Now, the amendment we did today on presumptive eligibility will probably raise the number of children and the total number in the bill. But I do think that it is a good start on moving down the road toward getting more of the uninsured insured in Minnesota. And it certainly represents more than I have seen in any other bill coming forward so far. Now, maybe there'll be some more ideas about how we can afford to expand this. That would be very welcome. But in the meantime, I think that we are doing what we can with the fund to focus on expanding access for the uninsured. The bill will have some general fund costs as well, and we are hoping that we will have a target in this division that will allow us to fund those general fund costs as well. We are going to be bringing more children into medical assistance. About 80% of the children, as I said earlier, are eligible for a public program. Most of those are eligible for medical assistance. And so if we bring more children into medical assistance, then that should be a general fund cost. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. There are still some blanks in the bill in regard to various grants, and we will be filling those in as we get a target for our division and see what we can afford to do.
There are questions from the committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, just since you mentioned the targets, what's the timeline on us getting targets, and if you have an idea on that?
Well, Senator, I think Berglund, it might happen this week, but I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund, do you have a motion?
Okay, then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 2 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Okay. Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the division.
And with that, the meeting will adjourn.
This note from you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be happy to schedule something. So I put a note in here for my